I got for fun ball and track. I'm proud to wear it now when I cruise around the other parts of the town. I got my decal and badge, so be true to your school.
And that was Be True to Your School by, I don't know. and I don't really have time to look it up right away. The Beach Boys? Okay, excellent. And you're about to, well, you are listening to WMFO in Medford. WMFO Medford. That is our legal ID. And you're also listening to Tufts Educational Radio at 91.5 FM. Also known as Tufts Freeform, commercial-free, community-based radio. And for the next couple hours, you're going to have a little slice of that community base with myself and Diego. And we're going to be talking about socialism, the big S word. Because you'll be listening to Socialist Alternative Radio, talk and music from a working class democratic socialist perspective. And welcome. And if you're new to our show, and Diego, you are now on the air. Do you want to introduce yourself?
Hello, Ike Four.
You're up. And Diego has a nice work story we got to get to, because we like to bring you... Okay, this gets into the introduction to the show thing I want to do really quickly. In addition to what I'm about to tell you, we also do true life, working class...
Scenarios.
Crap. Scenario stories of rotten things. Like off air, we talk about how...
Hello?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
I'm on, okay.
You're on, yeah. So, anyway, we'll get to those. But main reason for the show being on the air is... We like to give you alternative information from a, like we already said, working class democratic socialist perspective. That is absolutely true. But we also, unlike other shows that might exist in that format, sort of, very few, but they're out there, we're also trying to organize you into the socialist movement. There is such a thing, believe it or not. And you may see it here and there. And we're going to have a quote from Raoul Peck, the director of the Young Karl Marx. And that'll interest you probably. And there's other places where socialism suddenly, from Newsweek, by the way, that quote, there's places where socialism all of a sudden becomes part of the discussion. And more recently, with, you know, Bernie Sanders being identified as a socialist and people talking about that around him, with polling data showing socialism is more and more popular, especially among people of color and millennials and so on. And also just like Jacobin Magazine, a new magazine out there that gets a lot of circulation, and it's a socialist magazine. I mean, circulation in the, you know,
so
I believe tens of thousands.
So, the name Thatcher was wrong about history stops right now?
That was a philosopher named Fukuyama, an American, who, and I could be screwing up his name, who said that, and then later retracted it. Yeah, he had this whole thing about... the end of history.
Yeah.
And then he retracted
that. It stops right now.
It stopped when the Soviet Union fell.
It began when it rose, and now it fell.
Yeah.
It's like, really?
Yeah.
There was no other history beyond the Soviet before, you know, the Tsarist regime.
Right. Like all capitalist philosophers, not very materialistic, not very, and I don't mean materialism in terms of gaining possessions. I mean materialism in terms of science. Scientifically measuring
dialectical
things, dialectic materialism, etc., not using a method that's worth anything. Most bourgeois philosophers are basically using some sort of idealistic, eclectic way of looking at the world that can incorporate everything from religion to basic whatever will get to the biggest paycheck at the end of the week. But anyway, where else has socialism sort of punctuated the radar of the corporate media, gotten beyond that out into the society lately? The growth of socialist organizations, including Socialist Alternative. What else? Shama Sawant, Socialist Alternative candidate for mayor of, not for mayor, sorry, I wish, for city council
one
in
day.
Seattle. Yep. And not only elected once in 2013, but elected again, re-elected again with a larger margin in, I believe it was 2016 or 15. I have to check the date on that. And I was there helping with the campaign.
Who's
I remember
that
the exact
guy
date.
From Ohio that was a mayor, the socialist, or was he?
No socialist mayor of Ohio that I'm aware of. Are you thinking of the Democrat, Kucinich?
No, we spoke to him on the air a couple years ago.
There was a guy named Dan Labatz ran for senator under the Socialist Party, which is a small group but has ballot status in some places. And he ran a good campaign. He got a decent number of votes. And he, what is that background noise I'm hearing? It's like the machinery in here making some weird noise. Sorry, hopefully the audience can't hear it.
Might be outside too.
And so Dan Labatz ran a good campaign. We had him on the air afterwards. He has, in the past written for Labor Notes. He puts out books about labor and so on. Unfortunately, from my point of view or from the point of view of anyone interested in independent politics of the working class, he has recently sort of crossed that line over into sort of, supporting certain Democrats, certain liberal Democrats, out of some sort of, I guess what he would term some sort of political strategy, or I would term expediency, to influence people in DSA, which is a large socialist group called, or nominally a socialist group called Democratic Socialist of America, where they have a position of supporting Democratic Party candidates that they choose to support, and also some independent candidates, and also some DSA independent candidates. It's a sort of a mixed thing. The supporting the Democrats has been their main thing historically, and it's still the majority of what they do, supporting liberal, sort of what they call progressive Democrats. And, of course, there's a whole history on the left in America of trying to escape that, the Roach Motel of Democratic Party politics. Once you go in, you never come out. And I think that's still the most valid and most important question, that and question, not the question of, but the existence of racism and how to overcome racism in order to organize more effectively. I think that plus the Democratic Party are the main impediments to the left in the United States. Then, of course, there are international. And also, I would add to that, I guess a third one that I've been thinking about a lot lately is the lack of internationalism in the United States. Like, the United States is such a big, powerful country that some left groups, not ours, not Socialist Alternative, but some left groups sort of forget the international aspect of things. They think, and because the United States is so powerful and does call the shots in a lot of places around the world, does not make it immune from international economic things that are going on, and also political events. And if we're going to have socialism in the world, it's going to have to be in the world. It's going to be international. It can't be in one country. That's one of the main ideas we discuss and try to live by in Socialist Alternative. So we're in political solidarity with the Committee for Works International as well. This show is not just about alternative info, although you will get that, but it's also about, we're inviting you, listener, to check out the socialist movement, check out Socialist Alternative. Go to socialistalternative.org, read our latest paper, the parts of it that are online, read the latest stuff we've put up online, and get involved in what's going on now. And by socialist movement, I mean that in a broad sense, because socialists get involved in things. This is something a lot of people don't understand. Get involved in things that aren't explicitly socialist, that are just sort of reforms. And we understand they're going to be under capitalism. These are reforms that can be easily taken away. Look at all the things Trump has taken away that liberals thought were sacrosanct, and they were never. Nothing is sacrosanct. The wage you get, the law that says you should get 15 that we got passed in Seattle, we know that's not going to be forever under capitalism, even though we fought tooth and nail, as they say, for that law to be passed in Seattle. Socialist Alternative led the fight for 15, along with a lot of other people who participated, not trying to take full credit, but just saying that we initiated that fight in Seattle under 15 now, and we fought like a lot to get the $15 minimum wage bill passed. It got watered down a bit by our erstwhile allies, but the bill is still going into effect, and thousands of workers in Seattle are making $15 an hour now. And we're very proud of that. We did the same thing in Minnesota.
Next step is $20.
In Minneapolis, in Minnesota. And, well, that's what I was just going to say. That's funny you should say that. We're under no illusions that 15 is enough or that it will be there forever.
I was doing the math of what I'm making now. You know, if my rent goes up further, another $100 or so dollars, I'm still back where I'm at when I was making 12.
Yep, that's exactly right. I'm, of course, making more money, especially being married, than ever before. And I'm still living paycheck to paycheck. Go figure. It's not because we're. What's the opposite of someone that is an exorbitant spender? I'm so frugal now. For the most part, it's just it hurts, and some people are really proud of that. Oh yes, I make my own lunch and I do my own electrical work and I, you know, blah 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 blah. And I'm just a paragon of self sufficiency, and I'm saving money. And then you poke into those stories a little bit. And there's always something going on. Oh, you live with your parents still. I see. or you inherited money recently from some relative, or you know, I'm not trying to make light of that, but someone passed away and they gave you money. I understand now where you get that from. Or you got the job because you knew somebody. You know, you're a relative there, and so you know that got you set up and
patriot,
blah blah blah.
Not, you know,
yeah, you know, everyone thinks they're out, and that's not necessarily a bad thing. I'm just saying that, you know. Don't go bragging that you've solved the system. You know, capitalism is fine because I'm surviving. Oh, maybe you can do better than surviving. Maybe you should care about other people that aren't surviving. It's not their fault if they're not surviving because you lucked into this or that, you know? Because I've worked jobs where there was less than living. I worked like almost minimum. You know, I had that job at Barnes & Noble for a while as a part-time job. And I would sit there and you don't make any money except for on Sunday. You make barely a little bit. Because there's that law in Massachusetts that you get time and a half.
On retail.
Yeah, in retail. So I get, every once in a while, I get a Sunday shift and I'd be like, wow, it's almost worth going into work, wasting all my free time, you know, working at this place. Because I had a full-time job at the same time and I needed both, right? And so I'd see people that was their only job. And they had full-time or close to full-time or not full-time. Like part-time. And they're surviving barely. And I'm just like, you know, get to know them. And I'm like, oh, yeah, this is how you're doing that. And there was a lot of living at home stuff. There was a lot of, you know, money from another source, whatever, you know, family, another job, whatever. And there was a lot of, after the initial, you know, sort of bragging about how well people are doing. Not everyone did this, but you know, some people after their initial bragging about how well they're doing or talking about this or that. Like I was in Trader Joe's last night. I went to this Trader Joe's. By the way, they didn't have like five or six things I was looking for. It's going downhill fast, Trader Joe's, man.
Everywhere.
Really fast. And
Eden Market Casket, yeah. Whole Foods.
Yeah, and the people the workers there were not very happy. They were kind of Trader Joe's has a sort of jovial thing going on they do hire some older workers and they always kind of joke when you come. That wasn't going on last night. They were mad.
The
they were angry.
Did you get the captain?
No, I didn't.
Thing?
I didn't talk. I didn't talk
R.
to anyone.
I'll be like, stop with the R's already. What are you, a pirate?
I don't think they do that anymore. But I didn't do the thing with the managers. I didn't go up to the managers and say, "What's this? Where's this stuff?" I just dealt with the workers, and I think it might be like this was out in Natick, so there's like all these power shortages out there.
Oh,
like we went through, which we got to talk about for a second.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
But anyway, so I'm like, I think the power shortages have gotten to them because like they've gotten to me, you know. And all of a sudden, all that like jovial Trader Joe stuff was out the window, and everyone's mad and angry. I kind of liked it better; it's a little more honest. So there's all these things I couldn't find, and there was some stuff that they used to carry for years. You know, I don't go there that much. I go like once every couple months. And the workers had never heard of them. So I'm like, oh, you're new. I didn't say that, but I'm like, oh, you're brand new, man. You never heard of this thing? It was like one of their main things, you know, they don't have anymore. And I'm like, they're just going downhill fast, you know? And I don't care either way. I mean, you know, it's just, I just go there for certain things. But anyway, it was pretty sad. But what was the point of that story before Trader Joe's? I was leaning up to something.
Powers.
Oh, yeah, you know, so I'm walking by these two workers, and one of them's talking to the other worker about selling their house. I'm like, oh, that's interesting. Someone at Trader Joe's has a house to sell. A little odd. And they're not young, but they're like 30s maybe, you know? Because you can't make crap at Trader Joe's, right? So they need to be unionized, just like Whole Paycheck and all the other ones. So, but I had the fortune of being, it was a part of the store that I had to buy other stuff in. So I'm like, not trying to intrude and eavesdrop, but I'm just in their vicinity. And it starts to come out slowly but surely what they're talking about. Yeah, they're going to sell this house, right? But it needs a lot of work on it. So they're going to have to work that into the deal. They're going to get less money. And then when they go to the new place, they got all this work they got to do on that. They don't have any money for it. And they're going to do all this really crazy stuff to try to like get the money for that and get some, use this and go to IKEA and build a, you know. And I'm like, I know what you're talking about. It's called house poor. Yeah, there's a word for it, a term for it. You own a house, but you can't afford the taxes, the property taxes. You can't afford the mortgage. You can't afford to keep it up. And the repair starts to fall apart around you. And then of course, you have more trouble selling it. A lot of people are in that boat, man. A lot of people. So I was wondering, though, my initial thought was, though, here I am in Trader Joe's. I know I don't get paid anything. And this person has a house to sell. And the other person's talking like they know what they're talking about. And then I realized, you know, after I heard all that other stuff, oh, yeah, that's the kind of house you're talking about. Of course you are. I mean, that makes perfect sense, unfortunately, you know. Anyway, today's show.
Yesterday I went to one of the church meals, and this is lady who's so reactionary, Trump supporter, I just can't stand her.
Who works in a soup kitchen equivalent? Church meal. Works for No, what's a church meal? Sorry, say that. Does that mean? What does that mean?
Every other Saturday, it's a church like St. Peter's right by the YMCA in Central Square where they'll serve a meal.
So that's
to the public.
Ostensibly or nominally a charitable thing.
Yes.
Okay. So you're surprising me already with your story because she's a right winger, but she's doing this stuff.
Yeah, and she's not in the soup kitchen.
Just what
she's
we need.
Just somebody else who sits in and sits down and have a cup of
coffee. Oh, I see. She's there to eat the food, not serving it.
Yes.
I misunderstood. Sorry, go ahead. Sorry.
And she's like, look at this paper. She's looking at the Herald, right?
Yeah.
And there's like candles, a couple of candles. She's like, she's going off like, you think somebody got shot or something. This is just because the light is out. Come on, deal with it. Blah, 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 blah. So reactionary. Deal with it.
Yeah, deal with it. That's what.
And I wanted to tell her, like, well, number one, in the 70s, when things were regulated, you know, more, there was less outages or things would come back on right away, not in weeks.
Well, that's interesting. Let's talk about that for a second because I'm so glad you brought that up. But first, the deal with it thing, right? That's a thing deeply ingrained, unfortunately, in the working class, especially the American working class. Hopefully, not everywhere, but I'm not so sure. Where people take pride at how crappy their lives are. And they don't recognize how crappy their lives are because they take pride in how crappy their lives are. And what I mean by, I don't mean their inner worth as a human being or something. I'm talking about their conditions of living. That they don't, that if something's really horrible, they either were like, oh, other people have it worse, which may be true, but doesn't make the rottenness of what you're going through any better. And also, or like you just said, just deal with it, survive. Pride at being a survivor. And I can understand that. There is a certain pride at surviving all the things the system can throw at you. Totally get it. Feel that way myself a lot of times. But why be satisfied at that? Why be stuck at that level? Why not think, oh, I can maybe live a little better, maybe have my children or
also, why not
friends
think
or
of
relatives
the
live
past,
better?
You know,
yep.
This is not a norm. This is something that's been materially
created.
Yep.
It's not an accident.
It's dialectic. It wasn't like that back in the 70s or in the 60s. I mean,
not
you had
nature.
More unions and you had more regulations.
Yeah. Exactly.
Now you got all these NSTAR or Eversource or the grid or, you know what I mean? As opposed to just Edison or General Electric.
I've renamed Eversource Everscarce because their power is ever more scarce here in Massachusetts, here in the United States, by the way. If you're an international listener, we're talking about some winter storms that have come in quick succession. And both storms recently, now there's another one coming up on Tuesday. This is Sunday here now. What's the date today? March something,
11th.
Right? 11th, yeah, thanks. 2018, by the way. I mean to say the date at every show, and I never do it. I don't know. Anyway, so what are not that bad storms. They're bad, but they're not horrible. I remember much worse in the past. power all of a sudden is going out like insanely. So like you have hundreds of thousands of people without power. And today on the way in to this show, 58,000 people are still without power in Massachusetts. So at Puerto Rico, right, after the storm, which was a bad storm, really bad storm, but it's taken them, what is it, 6 months in? A lot of people still don't have power.
Closer, yeah, depending where you are, too.
Yeah. So but our point is here, obvious, but maybe not so obvious if you haven't thought about it. Was it always this way? Did a little bit of snow on a wire that should be buried anyway instead of, like my wife keeps saying, my wife Tina keeps saying, they bury those wires in Europe. Why do we have to suffer so much from every little snowfall, every little event that can knock a wire down, which can be a car accident? We had our power out one time because someone ran into the pole and knocked it down. We had our power out recently like everybody else three times.
I see one of those wooden poles for the wires, you know, for the transmitters.
That's what I'm talking about, yeah.
It's like this.
Yeah.
Like, it just takes a little car to hit it a certain way or wind. It's going to go right down.
I think they're doing a lot of gerrymandering or whatever the word is for that, where you fix something not very well just to get it running, and then you leave it there.
Yeah.
I see like the stupidest for
like a car
configure.
Mechanic. Let me fix. Yeah.
Here's some glue.
Yeah. Come back in a month when your whole entire transmission goes, you know.
I see the dumbest configurations of wood and wire I've ever seen. It's like they're making a performance art piece or something, you know, or I don't know what it is, a sculpture of late capitalist technology, where you have on the one hand the wonders of the smartphone, on the other hand we can't keep the electrical grid up. And they really can't. I mean, this is really much worse. Power went out when I was a kid, but much less frequently, right? And they got it fixed a lot quicker, exactly as what you said. Regulation and unions, and also probably people that wouldn't take this crap, you know,
like just do it right.
Yeah, they'd be like, if back in the 70s, or you know, if your power went out three times within 24 hours, and then a few days prior to that went out, you'd be like doing something about it, you know. But here in Massachusetts, it's like reported on, like, oh yes, then I haven't heard one news thing from the corporate media questioning whether ever scarce and national, we got to think of a word for national greed and ever scarce, whether they have enough workers here. And the answer is no, because I did hear on the corporate radio that they're calling in workers from Florida and every place else. Well, you know, why do you have to call in workers? You should have enough workers here for when this stuff's going to happen. Winter in New England? Yeah, you got to have a certain number of workers. And you might as well keep them on the rest of the year, because now we're having all sorts of violent storms because of climate change due to capitalism. Mm-hmm. They're not gearing up for that, because they're there to make money.
Yeah.
They're there to make money. Everscarce is some Texas crapola energy company, probably owned by the Bushes for all I know, you know?
It's out of Dallas.
Yeah. So, you know, Everscarce and national greed, nationalize them. Public ownership, elect the boards, regulation, unionize. We'll have power running 24/7. We'll have those lines buried instead of sticking up in the air, where everything from a low-flying airplane to a truck can hit them. You know, this is insane. But there's no workers' party here. You don't hear the Democrats out saying anything about this stuff. This is business as usual for the Democratic Party. Business as usual for the Republican Party. And the people are so sheepishly brainwashed into thinking that they don't deserve any more, or that there was never any past. And I'm saying that not out of derision, out of just, I'm sorry it's that way, but it's that way. You know, like when I hear people talking about the power outages, I don't hear anybody saying they could do a better job. They could do this X, Y, and Z. I hope you're out there.
You can hire more people.
If you're out there, I apologize for throwing you in the sheeple category, but I'm hearing a lot of nothing out there about this. It's just like where I work at Harvard. Harvard will not give the workers a snow day. We had one snow day in the last year or so, and they're bragging about it now. We're an urban campus, so the rich people that live in the freshman dorms, they can walk to their classes, true enough, but what about everybody else that has to commute in? How many people live in Harvard Square? How many people can live in Harvard Square? You know, if you're coming in any further than Harvard Square, whether it's public transport or your car or whatever, you're risking your life to get in, so this mega rich university, the richest in the world, can keep functioning to spew out more ruling class people, you know? I mean, ruling class, whatever they're going to be. Most Harvard people are going into finance now, high finance, right? So that's all I need to lose my life, so they can go trade some stock and get richer than they already are. This is ridiculous. My union leadership going along with it. No, they're not saying a peep about no snow days. That has messed my life up horribly, because I have kids.
And you live far now. You don't live around
We have
corner.
To take the time off. Because, A, let me explain it to anyone who hasn't thought this out, right? You work for this big mega company that could easily call a snow day. Easily, right? And let everyone stay home. It's a university. I mean, it's not the, you know, a necessary thing, I'm sorry to say, that you have to be up and running every single day at university. I mean, you got to keep the pipes running. So if there's absolutely essential personnel, call them in, give them a comp day. Maybe even give them comp day and a half or something.
What's comp day? Sorry.
You'll take it later. Take the vacation day later, the snow day later, mm-hmm. as a vacation day. Just comp, you know, like
have them there and then they can sleep in and
do whatever they maintain. Essential personnel, which would be very few people in a university, have them maintain the infrastructure so they can then, and because they're in there risking their lives getting in, they will then get a comp day or maybe more than that, maybe time and a half, comp day, whatever. None of that's happening at Harvard. Everybody's got to be in. Everybody come in, you know. There's some departments that are given permission to not do that. But as far as I know, that's the exception. The rule is everybody in for no good reason. And then you get in there and you risk your life to get in and you risk your life to go home. You go home into a house where the power's been out. You don't know if the pipes are going to freeze in your house. If that happens, if it happens enough in your house, the house is trashed. If it happens a little bit, it's tens of thousands of dollars possibly or $1,000 or whatever in repairs. But what I'm getting at is, what's your choice, right? If you have kids and the kids are home from school, you have to watch them or pay more than you can afford, much more than you can afford in some sort of ad hoc daycare system, you know? My kids are old enough, they're no longer in daycare. There's nowhere, we don't have any babysitter. We don't use babysitters. We can't afford that. We never used a babysitter, not once in our lives. So we have nowhere to send the kids, right? And we have to stay home with them, you know? And even if we had a babysitter or daycare, we shouldn't have to pay the extra money. That would wipe out your pay, your day's pay, easily. Oh, God, easily, to send your kids to that. Now, say you don't have kids. You're still risking your life to get in for no good reason. Or say you want to watch the kids of your, you know, relatives or something, you know? I mean, there's just so many scenarios where there's no reason for you to go to work and very good reasons to stay home. Like, deal with the power outages. They're now part of third world life here in America. I don't like that term third world, but I'm going to use it now as a reference point. No one do anything about it. No one complaining. I'm in touch with other union activists at Harvard, some, and I write letters and they're sympathetic, you know, and they want to do something about it, but the unionership won't do anything about it. They want to stay cozy in bed with Harvard management. It's a sin. It's a sin. It's horrible. It's absolutely horrible, especially when we're going to get into the West Virginia teachers. People that are not in bed with management, the West Virginia teachers, people that have a spine, that have a brain. We're going to talk about that in a minute, I hope. But we should tell your work story before we forget.
Also, my little interview at Harvard.
Oh,
I went into the layer of management, and this lady, she still hasn't emailed me or anything.
They are scum.
They are slow, aren't they, Jeff, huh?
Oh, slow. Yeah, they're slow on
purpose. They'll probably in a year or so be like, oh, by the way, remember we interviewed you? Yeah, I was homeless for a few minutes. I was relying on you.
I needed a job. I was unemployed. I needed a job so bad before I worked at Harvard. And I finally got one at a bookstore, but of course that was less than livable. That was like nothing wage. It was a small bookstore. I was like the only worker, one of two workers or something like that. So I'm dying for like a real job. And out of nowhere, after about 6 months, you know, I get a call from Harvard. And it was a really weird call because
when can you start? Or was it?
Yeah, no. Well, the minute
we still got to go through some processes.
Here's the weird part. They offered me the job on the phone. Bada boom. You know, this is what you'll start at, start this day. And the more I said, okay, yeah, that sounds good. Yeah, I'll be there. I wasn't excited, but I was like, yeah, I need this. Yeah, I didn't say that to them, but I said, yeah. They were, the more they wanted to yank my chain a little bit, the more they wanted to be like, oh, well, are you sure this is a starting wage is high enough for you? And are you sure you can start on this day? And they started to like question my yes in various ways. I don't even remember all the things they said. So at the end of the conversation, I'm like starting to get a little nervous. I'm like, well, yeah, I really, really want the job and I'll be there like you said at the beginning. You know? And then I found out this
I
found out. I found out this was I don't know if this is something that she was trained in or something this person excelled in.
Oh, psychologically profiling.
No,
people?
Wait. I'll tell you exactly what it is. This human resources person that I'm thinking of, I don't know if they did this to everybody or what. A friend of mine told me a similar story about when he got hired. And this was before I got hired. He'd already been there a while. And this person calls him into the office to offer him the job. And also there's this thing where she's black and he's black, and she's doing some like racial solidarity stuff, and he's going along with it because he wants the job, right? So he's like, yeah, and he, you know, nothing bad. It was fine, but then she's acting like really friendly, and he's like, oh, that went really well, and he walks out, and he already had the job. Get this, he had the job, right? She calls back and says, oh, you know, we can't really offer you what I said. We can only offer you Y instead of X in terms of a salary. Big, like, cut. So it was like this thing, you ever hear of bait and switch?
So to get your hopes up. 23.
Well, yeah.
And now it's 18.
And also, but getting you in, you're agreeing to something, you got nothing in writing, and just, like, you know, kind of sussing you out, like, how bad do you need the job, and... You know, how much can I manipulate you? You know, that kind of thing. And he unfortunately needed the job as like I did. And he's like, he took it. But what he said to me was he got so mad because of all the, like, you know, stuff she was saying, you know, white people that, you know, all the racial solidarity stuff. He was like, what a hypocrite. You know, she's like saying all this stuff to, like, you know,
divide and conquer.
Yeah.
She's
yeah.
like a ruling class.
To make him think that they're on the same side. In terms of work,
I'm with you, bro.
They were not on the same side. Yeah, exactly. Stuff like that, and he was like angry. He felt so betrayed. But you know,
that was in Whole Foods when
we
I
all
worked
learned
there.
From that. Yeah,
there was a supervisor, because a manager who was Ecuadorian, and he's like, you know, he's like, yo estoy aquí por you, for usted, because we're more, majority of us were Hispanic, and I'm like, well, what about my white brethren and my Afro-American brethren?
Yeah.
And he looked at me like, you know,
yeah.
like, don't just, you know, don't put yourself out there like you're here for la raza, you know what I mean? I'm like, come on, man.
Yeah.
We're all proletariat here, bro.
I got a story about that happening right now that is actually... a bad, bad story because it's holding up a very important union thing, but I'm not gonna say that over the air. But yeah, people have to unite to fight, you know, to fight the best.
Yep.
And that's another thing that, you know, that this teacher's strike we're gonna talk about. Oh my, the whole state went out. I mean, like they were. Like, I heard a report from somebody that was in. I was on a phone conference yesterday. Somebody that was in West Virginia. And from a bunch of people that were there, and they gave
now, Oklahoma,
they gave
they're
the statistic.
Help Oklahoma,
In April, that's a whole other story. There's a lot of workers in Oklahoma that want teachers that want to they want to go on strike now, and their leadership is holding things up. Which in the West Virginia strike, there was an element of going beyond what the leaders wanted. So at a certain point, we were calling that a wildcat strike. Because it was not officially sanctioned by the union leadership at a certain point, but it still won. And that's a very important lesson for workers to learn. Because we have a generation or two of union leaders that have turned kind of idiotic, really. They're kind of, well, I think they're stupid, actually. They're basically, they have no vision beyond capitalism. They don't understand everything you win, if you care about workers, everything you win as a union leader can be taken away tomorrow. By the capitalist state or by whatever, and you have to have that. You have to understand. You have to understand how the system works in order to fight it properly. And they're not even interested in understanding how the system works. A lot of them, so most of them. So that's a problem. That's
a
problem.
Most of them are part of it.
Well, they think Compliance. They are. They think they are. But I'm trying to find this. I took notes, and my notes are a little can't read them that well. But there was this amazing thing where the participation in the strike went way beyond what you would normally think that they had. Okay, here we go. Let me see if I can get this right now. This is from my notes. 32,000 total membership of the teachers' unions in West Virginia. Listen to this next figure. That's 32,000, but 33,000 went on strike.
So there was an extra 1,000.
What they did was, this was brilliant. They said, okay, and this again, this is despite the leaders. They somehow got around the union leadership on this one. They said, hey, we're going to go on strike. Us teachers, when we're in three different unions, they're in three different unions in West Virginia. One that's affiliated to the United Federation of Teachers, one that's affiliated to the American Federation of Teachers, one that is a union that is for school, two unions actually, so that I think there might be three or four, that's school bus drivers, dining hall workers, and so on. But they said, all the union leaders, in terms of the activists leading the strike, said, if we're going to go out on strike, we're not just going to have the union people vote. In our own union, we have all the union people vote, and even the non-union people that work in the schools. So they held this enormous vote, and everyone wanted to go out on strike. They even had supervisors, meaning principals and stuff at that level, supporting them. I don't know how widespread that was, but I'm just saying there were some, you know. But they took this strike vote that went beyond the confines of the union. That's called social unionism. That's the unionism that built the labor movement. And the word socialist, you could even put in socialist, because it was run by the organizers were imbued with socialist and communist and other ideas on the left. And that's what motivated them to build unions originally in this country and at different time periods. Now we're in a time
this
period.
This is 1886 for the May.
Well, this is beyond that. This is the 18. That's perfect, right? 1886, the 1800s. But also the 1920s, 1930s. 20s was a period of defeats and so on, but it was a lot. It was a growing for the left. The left was growing. And in the 30s, especially, the left shot up because of the Depression in terms of membership. Like the Communist Party got up to 100,000 members by 1938. All the left parties are growing. And they're all bringing those socialist ideas into the labor movement. And welcomed, by the way, by even conservative leaders, because they're like, oh, that's where the energy is. That's where they're showing up. We need them. You know, boom. Like, for example, that is John L. Lewis, famous labor figure from the 30s. Mm-hmm. Personally, very conservative. But the whole movement of the organizing of the CIO, the big, what they called sit-down strikes, which were really occupations of workplaces, big factories and other workplaces, this made Lewis all of a sudden left-wing in the sense of he became a spokesperson for strikes and occupations and protests that were led by socialists, and it was very interesting. And he would have to.
He knew history.
He went away with. He allowed communists to come into the mine workers' union and organize and stuff like that. And yeah, so that was a very interesting thing that happened. That he was basically propelled along by the movement. So despite his own conservatism, he was, and this happened to a lot of people actually. He became sort of a left winger, you know. You know, when things died down later in the late 40s, well, even in the late 40s, there were big strike waves, but I'd say in the 50s with McCarthyism and so on, you had a lot of people from labor leaders to intellectuals swearing off their old past. Yeah, I did that then, but now I believe in the system, blah, 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 you know. We're still suffering from that time. We're still suffering from the Communist Party supporting the Democratic Party in the 30s and a lot of left parties supporting the Democratic Party. We're suffering from the labor leaders that turned, you know, conservative again because of the short span of time in the post-war upswing. Not all of them, but, you know, because you still have the civil rights movement, black power movement, mass movements against the Vietnam War. There was a certain radicalization in the labor movement even then, even that late. But, you know, remember, like, give you a quick example. So McGovern runs. Remember 68, I think it was? Mm-hmm. McGovern, or was it 72? I can't remember. McGovern runs for president. He's a liberal Democrat, so I'm not saying that he should have been supported. But within the framework of a lot of labor leaders in the AFL-CIO, they were so tied to the Democratic Party by that time that they couldn't imagine not supporting a Democrat. But because McGovern was against the war and they were so conservative, still had a hand in the system and thought the war was for the good of the, you know, capitalists and therefore good for them and all that kind of business unionist crap, like Samuel Gompers, but later this would be like Kirkland, Lane Kirkland and people like that have so they actually voted for Nixon. You had like people putting Nixon back in power because they were afraid of the movement, the anti-war movement, and afraid of, you know, McGovern's liberal rhetoric around the war and peace rhetoric around the war, you know. That shows you how far right they were, how far away they were from social unionism, socialist unionism, you know what I mean? Just a quick example. But anyway, we got to tell you a work story. I swear we won't get to it because there's a lot of stuff to talk about. Yeah. So let's talk about that.
We'll do it towards the end if you want.
No, you can do it. Okay, well, let's jump into one other thing real quick, and then we'll get into the West Virginia teacher strike some more. By the way, I don't want to leave this point out, so I'm going to throw it out here now, and maybe we'll talk about it again. I found out through people on the ground that some of the teachers were wearing red T-shirts and red bandanas, and that was a conscious effort to use those colors to remember and to show publicly they were remembering the history of West Virginia, the big mine workers' strikes, and even the ones that go way back, like Blair Mountain and the Mingo County Wars and all these strikes that go back to the 20s that built the United Mine Workers Union in that area and so on.
It's like that movie Ironweed with Jack Nicholson.
It's about the miners. The more famous or more directly, maybe you're right. I don't know. I don't know much about Ironweed, so I shouldn't say anything. But I saw a little bit of it. Matewan or Matawan by John Sayles.
That's another one. Yes, that's
that was directly about that Mingo County Wars. Yeah. Anyway, so I found out, and this makes perfect sense, that even though the Mine Workers Union is now very weak in West Virginia, and you have a lot of workers there prior to this strike who were thinking more about the coal industry than they were the mine workers. And by the way, West Virginia went for Trump, I believe, right?
Voted?
I believe so, yeah. A lot of Trump supporters in West Virginia, whether or not the whole state went, I'd have to double check, but I think the whole state went. So here comes this militant strike, completely illegal, by the way, and we're going to talk about that later. Completely, if we remember, completely illegal in a right-to-work state, and 36,000, what is it? What did I say, 36,000? 33,000.
32,
teachers and others go out on strike and win hugely and keep their unity up and keep their bravery up, their courage up in the face of the whole state apparatus, because everything they did was illegal from start to finish. That's something that the labor movement has to understand. When a union leader says to you, say you're in a union, says, oh, you can't do that, it's illegal. The whole labor movement was built on illegality. Civil rights movement, everything was illegal. Jim Crow South, everything was illegal. The civil rights movement crashed and disobeyed and won rights. Everything is illegal, man. Slavery was illegal. These people, I'm talking about this a lot because I get in these wars on Facebook with conservative union people and it drives me crazy. Because they're like, and a lot of it's about immigrants. I'm like, immigrants are our brothers and sisters. Immigrants are our fellow workers. We need unity, socialism, blah, blah, blah. I'm getting all this stuff. And the thing they always come back on is, but illegal immigrants are illegal and it's against the law for them to immigrate here. So I just say, who cares? A lot of perfectly rational, sane, important things are against the law. A lot of good things are illegal. The whole labor movement that you're a part of, supposedly, was illegal at one time. Unions were illegal. A lot of things that unions do. There used to be this thing called, before Taft-Hartley Act, which is a horrible piece of legislation the Democrats, by the way, pushed through. Truman vetoed it, but just per forma, and then accepted it. But it was Democrats in Congress that were pushing it through. Taft-Hartley Act outlawed all these things that used to be legal. That's what I'm saying about 1 minute legal, 1 minute illegal type thing, mm-hmm. or always illegal but necessary. So the Taft-Hartley Act says you can't do sympathy strikes. Sympathy strike means a solidarity strike. So like if I'm in a union and I see another union on strike and we want to like put pressure on the company that is being struck, the company that the workers are refusing to work for, we would go on strike in support. And maybe that would just be a show of support. Maybe it would be we have something to do with that company, whatever. It's a solidarity strike or what was known as a sympathy strike. That was very effective stuff, man. Very effective stuff in the 30s. Very effective. They outlawed it in 1948 or 46, whenever Taft-Hartley went through. And you have labor leaders today saying, and we have the wonderful Taft-Hartley Act behind us. Are you insane? Here's the other side of the coin. It's still illegal, legally, in writing, to hire permanent replacements when you go on strike. But Reagan, when he was in power, he said, we don't interpret the law that way anymore. He said it for Reagan didn't have a thought in his head. He said this as a puppet for big business, when he was demented. That's not interpreted that way anymore. You can hire permanent replacements now. And the NLRB, ever since then, National Labor Relations Board, will rule that you can hire permanent replacements. Yes, you can. Where the law says you can't. That's how much law means in bourgeois society, in capitalism. It's law for the rich, one law for the rich, one for the poor. And that is not just a slogan. That is absolutely true. Because it's still the law that they can't hire permanent replacements, yet bosses and corporations all over the country are hiring permanent replacements when workers go on strike. That's why last year there were fewer strikes than ever, despite the West Virginia strike this year. Last year, fewer strikes than ever, because workers know that one of the things against them is that they can be permanently replaced. Now, you should still go on strike. You just have to organize a better way for it. Mm-hmm. But that's technically illegal. But they don't care. But then you have the same union leader that will say, hopefully they'll say that's a bad thing. But they'll also then obey slavishly every little law out there against unions. And every law's against unions. And how is the frickin' CIO built anyway, right? It was built in the big, what they called sit-down strikes, we already mentioned, in 1936-37. The what were called, what should more accurately be called workplace occupations, but they call them sit-down strikes. You sat down, but that wasn't, you didn't really just sit down. You actually formed guards and stuff. And it was a brilliant tactic because the bosses were afraid to come in. The corporations were afraid to come in and wreck their own machinery and get the bad publicity. They tried. I mean, there was strikes where they'd send in a National Guard, set up the machine guns, and then you'd have like the wives and mothers and women of the strikers would go out and form. There was famous examples where they'd form auxiliary pickets. So then the National Guard people had to figure out, am I going to start shooting my mother or people like my mother? For who? For some rich guy? Mm-hmm. Fell apart fast, man. Fell apart real fast.
Then the hooligans, like they did in France in 1936.
Yeah, thugs. They did that a lot. They still do it. They'll send in private security. They'll send in thugs. They'll send in cops.
The Pendertons.
And Pinkertons. Yep. That's why they exist. Yep. The Pinkertons and exist. The cops tend to do no matter what.
Because if the cop can't do it, because he's
the cop does it. Now I'm trying to make a distinction here. Army, National Guard, different from the cops. The cops will often engage in some really bad behavior at the behest of their bosses.
They got the pepper sprays and what have you.
I've been the recipient of some of that thump. Bad behavior on
I heard lines. That in Houston, thump, when they hit you with a rubber bullet.
Yeah.
Son of a.
Yeah.
So somebody else got hit.
For peaceful protesting. Peaceful protesting, right? Yes. Yeah, there you go. So I'm not saying cops felt guilty. I wish they felt more guilty about the stuff they do. I'm talking when it comes to that kind of stuff. What I'm talking about is National Guard and Army, that's from the working class. There aren't enough rich people. They're not paid that well. Cops are paid really well for the most part. So it's like when you get National Guard and you get the Army called into stuff they're not supposed to be called into, by the way, sometimes there is solidarity. I don't want to exaggerate that because the mentality of a lot of National Guard and Army people is not that great.
Have you seen Detroit?
But it
the
has
movie
happened.
Detroit? It's about Detroit in the 67.
No, I haven't. Nope.
Oh, Jeff, you got to watch this movie because there was a part in it where the cops were basically had this. It's a, I don't want to ruin it for you, but a house where somebody was shooting at. And it was just, you know, I guess it was just blanks. It wasn't real bullets. But the cops went there, rounded the people, these guys up, you know, African-Americans. And they were doing them wrong. You know what I mean?
Yep.
Whatever, and then then they wanted to kill them to kind of like wipe, you know, hey, if they come
like
here
in
and
Orleans.
They investigate, this is going to be internal affairs, let's just get rid of them right now, nobody will ask questions, you know? But there was a National Guard who helped some of them escape these cops, you know, holding them hostage, basically.
Yep. And again, I'm not trying to say that always happens at all, but there are just examples where this kind of public shaming or solidarity of people helping the strikers, they call them auxiliary pickets, had a huge effect. And you'd have the National Guard thinking twice. Now, they didn't think twice at Kent State. They gladly shot down protesters, you know, and innocent people. The protesters were innocent too, but people that weren't even protesting. So it's not, of course it doesn't always happen, but I'm just saying there's a difference between an army and a National Guard, especially back then with a draft that you're conscripted into, where they have to draw from the working class. They don't have enough people and from any other class to populate a whole army or a whole National Guard, you know? Anyway, that's a bit of a tangent, but maybe an important one to think about because we're talking about the labor movement has to do illegal things to survive and for working people have to be part of that so-called illegal stuff to survive and to even get better lives. So you have to understand, we're talking about the corporate media is not saying this, but the West Virginia teacher strike was illegal from day one. They have laws in most states I'm aware of, including the liberal, so-called liberal states they are liberal states. Liberal is just another part of capitalism. Where public sector workers are forbidden, they're illegal. It's legal to go on strike. You're not allowed to by law. Now, I remember in the 70s, even into the 80s, teachers would defy those laws fairly routinely and win. It just happened out in Seattle as well. Big Seattle teacher strike won recently. Chicago teachers won a few years ago. I don't know about Illinois and Washington. I have to double check, but I would bet you those strikes were illegal. West Virginia was definitely illegal. But what I'm saying is that when I was, what I'm adding to that is that when I was a kid, I would see these illegal strikes in the 60s and 70s of teachers. And back then, because the movement was much, there were more unions and there was the whole big anti-war movement and all the other big movements, the women's movement and stuff that came out of it, again, civil rights, black power movement. The state and the states were just, the government, the federal government and the state governments, they were afraid to enforce those laws. They wouldn't enforce them. They wouldn't throw teachers in jail for the most part. Then they got, in the 90s and 2000s, they started throwing teachers in jail for illegal strikes and stuff. It still doesn't happen all the time. And that's the main message that I'm trying to get through here, is that if you're in a teacher's union and one of your unions says it's illegal for us to go on strike, say, where have you been for the entire history of our union? We've gone on strike many, many times. We've done it because we had to. And the fact that it's technically illegal means absolutely nothing, because it's an unjust law and we must break that law. It's like laws that enforce slavery. Do you follow a law that enforces slavery? Do you break that law every chance you get?
Run away.
You break it. Well, you helped the runaways, which was illegal. Everything was illegal. You know,
the Underground Railroad.
The whole legal system was not the whole legal system, but like most of it, a lot of it was there just to keep that slave system going, you know? And Jim Crow, you know, the Southern politicians, Southern Democrats get the blame for that, and they should. But the people like Roosevelt, the big liberal icons, Kennedy, Johnson, they all kept that system in line, right? They kept it going. They gave it support until they felt like they could go, after the movement gave them some room to go against it, like with Kennedy a little bit, because that was part of the way they got elected. They could rely on the Southern Democrats to get them so many votes to get national power, as long as they didn't touch Jim Crow. Or really go after Jim Crow. That's why the Southern political establishment is now Republican. Because that deal's gone now. Jim Crow was smashed by the Civil Rights Movement. So they don't need the conservative wing, if you want to call it that. That's really a little stretch, because it was all conservative in a way. They don't need that agreement anymore. You know, they're keeping their power base. They're gerrymandering through the Republicans. They got the cops going crazy on people on their own and through the Republican Party. They don't need the Democratic Party anymore like they did before, you know? Although you might see that switch around now a little bit, because if they have to use populism to stay in power and use some sort of progressive populism, they might find the Democrats a more convenient vehicle for that, you know, like in that election that just happened in Alabama. Was it Alabama where you had the crazy Republican guy?
Yeah.
Total nut job.
Democrat.
And then you had the typical Democrat. Yeah.
He got in
and immediately started talking good about Trump and all that
then
stuff.
Then he's walking the plank with Trump.
Anyway, let's get into that Rollo
Peck. But, you know,
historically,
right, the Republican Party, wasn't it the Republican Party, the abolitionists historically in
It all flipped. Yeah, they were a third party, Republican Party, and they became a party in favor of abolition, supposedly. I'd have to double check on that. I don't know if all of them were or not.
Because there was this thing on, like, Lincoln and the exchanges of Lincoln with Marx.
Yep, there was.
At the time, correspondence.
Yep. The Marxists supported, Marx and Marxists supported the North in the Civil War. And Marx wrote a lot of journalism about the American Civil War for European audiences, I believe, or maybe one country, maybe it was Britain, I'm not sure. Let's see. I just got to fill out this paperwork here.
So Raoul Peck.
Yeah, Raoul Peck.
Karl Marx.
Let me hold on. Let me just write this down here. Yeah. Type it in.
So yeah, Jeff, you got to watch Detroit. That's one movie is working class. It's
I don't know anything about
intense.
It.
It's intense. Yeah, I just seen it at the library and just grabbed it.
I heard about it when it came out. Yeah,
yeah, you got to watch it.
Never saw
it. The kid that played I forgot his. I don't even know his name. He played in the new role. What was it? The Force Awakening of Star Wars.
Oh wow, really?
Yeah, he's in it. He's a guard. Okay. He's like a police guard, and he's kind of like. Okay. Yeah, you really got to watch that movie.
Yes.
I highly recommend it.
Yeah, definitely. I'm just doing another little thing here that I shouldn't be. There we go. Oh, come on. Wait a minute. That's already up and running. Yeah, right. So open it. Yeah. Sorry, listeners. There's little things to be done here. Okay, Raoul Peck, as we promised. So you might have heard there's a new film out called The Young Karl Marx. It's a drama. It's directed by Raoul Peck, who did that film about James Baldwin that was very successful last year or the year before. I can't remember which. And I don't have a full biography of Raoul Peck. I meant to research him. I didn't have time. I'm sorry. And I'm sorry I'm ignorant about him, because this guy is amazing. He's a genius, it seems like, to me. Listen to this. This is from Newsweek asking him about his film. He goes, quote, Raoul Peck, the director of The Young Karl Marx. And the title of this Newsweek review or article about it, or interview, there's actually a longer review, is Director Raoul Peck on Why We Need The Young Karl Marx. It's from February 23rd, Newsweek, Andrew Whalen, W-H-A-L-E-N. Quote from Raoul Peck from this interview. When you read an important book like The Communist Manifesto, it was a book written for workers in a very simple way so they can understand their life and their struggle. When you read the first chapter, it's exactly a description of what's happened in the last 30 years. The expansion of capitalism. The total craziness of speculation. The fact that it will invade the whole planet. That's exactly what happened. So it's important to know your history. Otherwise, you're just a puppet following the next populist who promises you paradise. Now, the way I interpret that last line, and I think probably it's not a stretch. I think Raoul Peck would agree with this, is I think he's thinking of, like, you know, Democratic Party populists, you know, including Sanders, I would say. You know, they can talk a good talk, but if they keep everything in the confines of the Democratic Party, they don't walk the walk, you know. But and more importantly, the quote, in a way, the quote is saying, in my opinion, read the Communist Manifesto. You know, these ideas are extremely relevant for today. So anyway, then there's a couple quotes I wanted to say really quick from the interview slash article about the interview, whatever. This is the first paragraph of the thing. When Raoul Peck, director of The Young Karl Marx, defines what success would look like, it's not in box office terms. Instead, Peck hopes the movie and the man brought to life by actor August Diehl can be a rallying point for disparate leftists, socialists, progressives, social democrats, and anti-authoritarians emerging in response to a global wave of right-wing capitalist power. Nice. That's what we're on the air for, yeah. You know, for the most part. That's brilliant. We love that. We love that. This guy,
we can't live off of the salary we get here.
this guy's really good. Now here's the deal, though. Quote, a limited theatrical run for The Young Karl Marx begins Friday. So that was, what, a week or two ago, at least. 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago. Quote, Peck found the reception in France especially heartening, where youth movements centered meetings and reunions around screenings of the film. Quote, all those parties fight each other, so it was interesting to see something that rings true, that draws them all together despite their political fights, Peck told Newsweek. That's a fundament? I don't know what that means. Testament, maybe, to the movement. This is a total digression.
It's typos.
Newsweek has a lot of typos. No, everywhere now. Everywhere.
Even books.
The whole corporate media is trying to get more and more money by wringing out the work with fewer and fewer workers and laying standards, such as what, if they even had any to begin with, get even worse. I see so many typos now. I'd say testament. There's a testament to the movement that they need to come back to, because Marx was not dogmatic. Marx always said you need to reanalyze your current situation and your historic situation. And that's true, by the way, of Socialist Alternative and any good Marxist. Less than a biopic, meaning biography picture, than the history of an idea, The Young Karl Marx builds to the publication of the Communist Manifesto in 1848, shaped by both the rowdy halls of contemporary socialist discourse and his fruitful collaboration with Friedrich Engels. The Young Karl Marx rebukes many of the most common misconceptions about the man, meaning Marx, and his work. Marx's analysis of capitalist society in the wake of the Industrial Revolution didn't invent communism or any of the other ideologies we associate with Marxism, but instead offered a systematic rigor to what was otherwise a loose movement of populist, young Hegelian intellectuals, street agitators, Christian millennialism, and striking workers. Because of my, quote, quoting Peck again, because of my upbringing and my political engagement, I don't believe in an individual saving anybody. That would be very populist, and we see that in the electoral process. Now Peck is obviously using populism also to mean right-wing populists that are out there now.
Like Trump.
Yeah, and also in Europe, I think he might be based in Europe, I'm not sure. Macron in France, who some wouldn't call right, but he is. He's a Thatcher of France now. Le Pen, of, you know, the Austrian right that just got a lot of votes, relatively speaking. That guy, Wim Wenders or whatever, in the Netherlands, that got set back, but I don't think he's gone yet. etc. Yeah, you pick your right wing poison in Europe right now. It's there. The young Karl Marx is awash in clamoring groups and competing interests, particularly the League of the Just, a loose revolutionary coalition for international workers riven by strategic disagreements, who find new purpose as the Communist League, for which Marx and Engels wrote the manifesto. The young Karl Marx depicts political infighting and the turmoil of organizing as a necessary condition for change. You can't force, and then Raoul, I think this is Raoul Peck again, you can't force somebody to vote for you. You have to convince them. It's about discussion. It's about...